The Beer EDU Podcast, Episode 108, Tech Maverick with Mike Lawrence. Welcome to the Beer EDU Podcast, the podcast for educators that love to learn and share ideas with fellow educators over beers, with your hosts, Kyle Anderson and Ben Dixon.
Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Ben, what's going on?
Not much. Hey, it is another episode of the Beer EDU because we're here and it's episode 108, my friend.
Yes, indeed. 108 of the podcast. And if we're on the podcast, we're going to be drinking some beers. But first, introductions. I am Kyle Anderson. You can find me on Twitter at AndersonEdTech. Same thing with the Instagram. AndersonEdTech.net is my blog, and then I'm also the author of To the Edge, Successes and Failures Through Risk-Taking. You can learn more about that at ToTheEdgeEDU.com. It's available on Amazon. It's on BarnesandNoble.com through my publisher, EduMatch Publishing, all those good places. And you, my friend, you are?
I am Ben Dixon. I'm an administrator here in Northern Nevada. I'm outside right now, as you can hear by the dogs barking. And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at BDixonNV. I have a much neglected blog, but I am working on a post right now, which will be like, I think, 2 years from when I've posted last. So I'm super excited about that.
Hey, it's never too late. Never too late. So
I know. I think the last thing you posted was like, I haven't posted for 2 months. And I was like, really? 2 months, dude? Really?
Yeah. If we're making this a competition, yes, you win. So
yeah. Hey, no, Kyle, beer to you, man. What do you got?
So I am drinking a gift from our good friend Adam Juarez. He passed through Las Vegas a few weeks ago on a west, kind of west of the Rockies road trip that he did. He basically went from Central Valley of California to Colorado Springs and then south down through New Mexico and then through Arizona and then to LA and back. So he did a nice little road trip, but he brought me Tioga Sequoia beer from Fresno, and he brought me some General Sherman IPA, 7.5% ABV, 60 IBU. It's named after the General Sherman tree in Sequoia National Park. This is the largest living tree in the world.
I've seen it.
I've never been to Sequoia National Park. I've seen it. I've wanted to. I've been wanting to go there in Kings Canyon for years. It's tough to get to from Las Vegas, though, because there's no east entrance. No. If there was an east entrance... 2.5-3 hour drive.
You got to go all the way over and then go up.
Yeah. So you're talking, it's a 6 hour drive minimum to go there. So that's part of the reason why I've never been there, which I just need to go. I mean, I've been to Fresno enough. But anyway, so this beer, classic West Coast IPA.
Yep.
You got Simcoe, you got Citra, you got Mosaic hops. Throw that combination together. It's simple, it's delicious, it's awesome. I love this stuff. I'm glad he was able to bring this to me because I can't get this in Las Vegas.
Awesome, man. Cool. I have to. Yeah, that is. I have been there as one of my many trips as a child. My parents very much about going to look at big trees, which is a whole other story. So cool, man. So my beer is something that I tried when we were back in New York visiting my daughter in Brooklyn. I went with the Brooklyn Brewery. It is their Stonewall Inn IPA. So they did a special batch of IPA, 4% 4% ABV, so it's a session IPA, so kind of lower on the alcohol side. No IBUs listed, but the whole point of this was to celebrate the Stonewall Inn uprising in 1969 to push for more gay rights. So it is part of their LGBTQ initiative. To all the money that they're raising, they're kicking it back into that initiative. So I think that's a super cool community to give back to. And I think I applaud Brooklyn Brewing for doing that. It came in a super cool can. And I wish I should have brought some beer back. You can get Brooklyn Brewery here in Reno, but not this one. So they do their standard lager is pretty much straight across. I'm pretty sure you can get that anywhere in the United States. It's one of their biggest breweries. But so that's what I went with. That was mine. Not what I'm drinking tonight, unfortunately, but that is my beer of choice for tonight.
It's definitely a good one to share, though, just because, great cause. Yeah. And I haven't had a bad beer from Brooklyn Brewery. The limited ones I have had because, again, here out west, a little bit tougher to get. But there are some really good ones do make it way out the way out here. So I'm sure this Stonewall in IPA is not one of them that's making it here. Yeah. Then, so.
Great. It's a solid session IPA.
All right. So, well, hey, we have a guest with us that is going to be sharing a beer as well. So with us today is Mike Lawrence. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, guys. Hey, so good to be here.
Awesome to have you, man.
Yeah, I was feeling really good about my beer until you described yours. Mine has no good cause associated with it whatsoever, but it's tasty.
Yeah, you cracked yours before we started recording, and I am super jealous. Like, if you're following us on the live stream, you got to check this out.
Yeah.
So we covered this style a while back, and this is one that Ben and I both said that this is a great style. So, yeah, just without further ado, just tell us about this beer.
Yes.
So this is from Beechwood Blendery. My buddy Ken works there, and I told him I was on this podcast called Beer EDU, and I needed something special. And he's like, I have just the thing. So this is a Belgian-style sour ale fermented and aged in oak barrels with boysenberries. And it's three different blends of year old blends, and so it's 2020, and it's essentially been fermenting, and it's super tasty. And here's what it looks like after the pour. I'm sorry for the glare, but I'm trying to figure out where to put it to
avoid the glare. It is a beautiful red with some nice carbonation. In a cool glass, I will tell you.
Yes, and a shout out to Hall Davidson. Hall Davidson got me this this blown glass that has a bottle within the glass. So it's kind of an upside down bottle.
Well, and the name of the beer is amazing too. It's called Funk Yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah. just an incredible name for a beer. And I did a little research on it. So 6.4% ABV. So not your typical lambic style. It's that Yuza style that we covered a few weeks back. So it's amped up. It's blended and everything like Mike was saying. So yeah, I need to go down to Long Beach now and get a hold of some of this stuff because, I mean, just when you pop that cork and poured that thing before we started recording, I'm like, oh, that just sold me on it right there.
Yeah, and there's this cool artwork on the end of the cork, too. I don't know if it
on
the thing. So, yeah, well, let me know before you come. I'm not too far from Long Beach, and I'll get my friend Ken to get us a tour or give us the behind-the-scenes thing. So...
Well, and I think, and we've talked about this a little bit on the show. We've touched on it. I mean, there's really an art to bottling. There's an art to presentation. And I mean, I think that's super cool. Is like when you go into that super fine detail of like putting art on the cork, which beer doesn't normally have cork. Yep. That's most people are going to be like, beer doesn't have cork. Yes, it does. Some beers.
Yeah. And there's another brewery right not too far from here. It's Common Space, and it's right next to SpaceX. And so they have really interesting artwork. Like they commission local unknown artists to do their can artwork. And then they give them special names and then they sell, you know, limited release of the prints. It's really neat that they're supporting art through the sale of beer, which is itself an art.
Right on.
That's it. That's all I got. So thanks so much.
Well, thanks everybody for joining us this week. That'll be the end of the show. No, absolutely not.
So, I believe Mike does some other things that like, I don't know if this might be like, Mike's got enough stuff that this might have to be a two-parter. I'm just saying as I'm like scrolling through and I'm reading, I'm like, oh, this and this. So Mike, let's just start with who are you? What do you do? What are you passionate about?
So I live in Southern California with my wife and two kids, and I started my professional career as an educator. I was a high school English teacher, loved teaching the kids. I wrote 3 or 4 classes, got them approved at the state level. It was hard to leave the classroom because I was teaching web design, a class I had developed and written. I was teaching 3 sections of freshman English, and I love freshman English. I love teaching, you know, myths and mice and men. And then I was also teaching a sci-fi lit class that I wrote myself. And it was a junior-senior elective you could take to replace American or Brit lit, so you didn't have to do both. And I had a whole bunch of people that did not consider themselves readers, did not like writing, and they came in. Basically, I sold them on the sci-fi aspect of it and the robots and cyborgs and all that. And they showed up, and I gave them the good stuff. I gave them good science fiction.
So I'm totally going to interrupt because I am a sci-fi nerd. So, what is your go-to for to get them hooked? What was it?
Ender's Game is the go-to. Ender's Game is the hook. And I had a copy and I thought, should I bring it out? I'm not going to talk about Ender's Game. But every time I'm in a bookstore, any used bookstore, and I find a copy of Ender's Game, I buy it because I just give it away. I just end up giving away copies. Like I'm that crazy former English teacher just walking around handing books out. And usually it's Ender's Game. And then the next one, it's a little thicker to get through, but it's a brilliant book. It's Frankenstein. Those are like the two, two books. And it, nice. I look at it as the first science fiction book. It was right when the novel was new.
Yes.
It's, you know, Mary Shelley, who didn't get credit for it for the first 50 years because they assumed that a 19-year-old woman couldn't possibly have written this when she's married to Percy, the, poet, the famous poet. It must have been him. And no, ladies and gentlemen, she was the only one that night that finished her book. That they did the ghost stories they all told with Lord Byron and Percy Shelley. Yep. Mary Shelley just knocked it out of the park with that. And it's a masterclass in narrative. It's got narrative, framed narrative within framed narrative. Anyway, I love that.
Yeah. So I'm a frustrated English. Like I started as an English major and then switched to elementary. So you're speaking my language, man.
All right.
I well, hear you right now.
Here's the test. This was the test at the end of the year when I got to the final work that we covered. I would present Shakespeare's Tempest as a science fiction play.
Oh.
And if they and my test, the reason it was a test was if they balked, I would have failed because I feel like the whole year I would have secretly sucked them into talking about literature and writing about literature when they were convinced they weren't readers, they weren't essay writers. And then if I got to the end and they go, "What? We're reading Shakespeare? I thought I was here for the sci-fi." And never did I have that reaction. I feel like I succeeded because by the end, when I presented Shakespeare, and the way I did it was I showed, of course, you know, the movie, Forbidden Planet. You show Forbidden Planet with Robbie the Robot, danger, danger. And they get hooked on that. And then you say, okay, I have the story that's based on, and it's written by this guy, Willie Shakespeare. Let me pull that out. Here you go. Here's copies of it. It's called The Tempest. And instead of a spaceship, it's a ship. And instead of a planet, it's an island. And it's the same story. Instead of magic, it's technology. And I did that flip at the end. And every year I got them. And I was like, yes. So
nice.
Anyway, I did do that. And then I left the classroom. It was really difficult. I missed the kids. I don't miss the grading. Or the journals. All the journals I carried home. I went into administration. Administered educational technology for the County of Orange. There's 500,000 students here in California. It's where Disneyland is. We have about 28 districts that we support. And so coordinated technology there. That got me hooked up with this nonprofit called Q. Q had an opening for an executive director. I was encouraged to apply. I said, who, me? I'm like a third tier nobody at a county office. But I applied and got the job. And I was Q's youngest executive director in its history. Served in that role, eventually became CEO for the last 3 years, and left that role in 2017. So 13-year stint, which was an amazing ride. It was incredible. And I feel that Q gave me ultimately more than I ever gave it. It was such an amazing network. It was a chance to really impact lives beyond the classroom that I was in or even the county that I had served as an administrator. I was able to do things that were statewide. Multiple states and then nationally, and even in some cases, we did some things that were global in nature. Made the shift to consulting, decided that I don't like having five bosses. That was tricky. And had this great opportunity to go work for on the vendor side of things. And my good friend, Hall Davidson, the guy that got me the glass, Hall has worked at Discovery Education for years. And he said, Mike, here's the thing. You've been working in education technology for 20 odd years now. You've always been helping educators and you yourself using technology that someone else made. Wouldn't you like to go and help make the technology? Wouldn't you like to go on that side of things for once? And I was like, oh, well, when you put it that way, yes. How could I say no? So ironically, it wasn't the sales pitch from PowerSchool at the time. It was actually the sales pitch from my friend and mentor, Hall Davidson, that convinced me, oh yeah, this is absolutely the right step. So I did that for 3 years, had an amazing learning opportunity, and then shifted over to Jamf. I'm now at Jamf, the Apple MDM solution that helps organizations succeed with Apple. And they needed someone that understood education to come in and talk to folks on the curricular side. And I'm really excited to do that globally, essentially leading strategic initiatives for Jamf. Here's Jim. Here you are. You can see the logo. Boom.
Now, I do have questions about Jamf. I've never heard of this until now, to tell you the truth. So I do have questions.
But yeah, me too.
I do need to back up, though, going back to your experience as an English teacher, because I'm a late bloomer sci-fi guy. I didn't get into sci-fi or like even Star Wars until I was a full-grown adult. So you're talking like it just was something that my parents weren't into. So I wasn't exposed to it, and most of my friends weren't into it either. So like when the Star Wars prequel movies, the first one came out, I think I was a junior in high school, I think, when that one came out. And I remember some kid walking into math like 20 minutes late, just all disheveled because they had camped outside the movie theater in my hometown to get tickets for it and whatever. I'm like, seriously, a movie's that important? You camped overnight for tickets? You couldn't have just waited for it? He goes, no, you don't understand, whatever. Well, then, of course, that movie ends up becoming one that people just rip on all the time still to this day, but I digress. But hearing about how you presented sci-fi to students would have totally hooked me in and got me going on at an earlier age. And then the other thing was, Shakespeare, I still have nightmares about doing Shakespeare. I could not stand that. I don't know if it was because I was forced as a freshman to, we all had to recite like a 50 to 75 line portion, whatever you want to call it, of Romeo and Juliet in front of class. We had to memorize this. This wasn't like, you know, here's the book, now do it. We were forced to memorize this thing. And what it was the prince, when he comes in and breaks up the fight between the families and Romeo and Juliet, throw your mistempered weapons to the ground. I still remember that line because I was forced to memorize that thing. And I don't know if it's because of that or so much of it is so dry. I don't know, but I couldn't stand Shakespeare. But just hearing how you did that, I would love to go back to high school just for a day. Just to see what it was like. I don't want to go back to high school because whatever. I enjoyed high school, but not that much.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things that is far too often inflicted upon students, and instead of something that you invite them into. One of the ways I would hook kids into Shakespeare is I would give them an assignment, and I would warn the parents ahead of time. Back to school night, I'd tell them, look, there is legitimately going to be an assignment where I tell your child to go home and watch TV. And they need to watch not any TV. It has to be a sitcom. It has to be a formulaic 30-minute episode with four commercial breaks. Because you know what that does? It breaks it up into five acts. You know what else has five acts? Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I said, so the assignment will be that they have to watch some five-act sitcom show. Take notes on it. And it is a legitimate thing. Because I would have parents like tell them, no, you can't watch TV. I don't care if your teacher said you can. Like, no, it's legit science. I need to get them a TV and watch it. And then I would show them some common episode of a TV show. I'd bring it in and I'd have recorded it the night before on VHS. And then I'd bring it in and we'd dissect it. And they would have dissected it. Now, this did bite me a couple times because two shows that were popular during that time were Seinfeld and Friends. And both of them, because they're true ensemble shows, you get really tripped up with the A and the B and the C and the D plot. And with Friends, it was, you know, sometimes an E and an F plot. So I would tell them if they end up picking a show that has a true ensemble, they need to pick the A plot if they can, or just pick one of the characters and follow their tribulations. But it does sort of mess up the five act structure because, you know, there's only so many minutes in a 30-minute window. But that would be our entree into it. And then I would say, okay, look, how many people feel that sitcom TV is like top tier fiction writing of the day? And they know, no, that's not. It's not the big stuff. It's not generally well regarded. Yes, there's an Emmy Awards ceremony, but it's not like literature. It's not seen as exciting as movies, right? They still have a higher tier. I said, imagine that, but even lower. I said, how about like soap operas? Think about soap operas and how they're considered right now. If you're an actor in a movie, you know, like a Laurence Olivier versus a soap opera actor. I said, soap operas, that's what Shakespeare was writing for. The equivalent in Elizabethan England, they looked down on it. It was for the poorest people. It was for those people that were sort of vulgar and, you know, just not those that were of the high class. And so I would bring him in that way and say, that's how he was viewed in his own time. And we just had fun with it. But you're right. And I think the other piece of it is, and what your teacher was probably trying to do, is that Shakespeare's meant to be heard. It's not meant to be read off the page. And that's what kills so many students, because they're forced to read page after page after page alone in their head with no one hearing it sort of spoken as the poetry that it is, right. But it's hard to get it out as poetry when you can't get through the language. The early modern English is just right. too difficult sometimes. So yeah, I would totally go with the retranslations, the modern English interpretations, mm-hmm. showing the Forbidden Planets, showing, and at that time we had Romeo plus Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann movie came out. And I was like, mm-hmm. I am on board. This is it. Cause this is a language that my high school students will understand. The romance of it, they get it. The violence of it, they get it. So all of a sudden, you know, their sword is a gun right mm-hmm. now. They got it. So it was, that was transformative as well. So, I think it has to be the way you present it and the yeah. luck of the timing, right?
Well, a movie that come out, I was either late high school or early college when it came out, 10 Things I Hate About You is totally based off of Taming of the Shrew.
Right.
You know, which to this day, I sat down and watched that movie a while back and, you know, still thought it was hilarious and still.
It's an amazing movie.
Yeah. And rest his soul, Heath Ledger, still can't believe. You know, he's gone. He was so good in that movie. So,
I'm old enough that I'm like, I'm talking about the original with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. So,
yeah, well,
the other thing, then there's the that. Other thing, especially the other thing I found, especially with freshman boys, was you tell them that, look, Shakespeare wrote for vulgar audiences. So he would sneak in these dirty jokes. Now I, as a public school teacher, I can't talk about those, but if you were to find them on your own,
yep,
I can't help that. You're just doing a proper close reading of Shakespeare. And so I had these horny freshman boys dive into Shakespeare, go doing close readings, and they'd run up to me and they go, Mr. Lawrence, he's talking about his sword. And I go, yeah, no, he actually is talking about his sword. It's just his sword. But I see what you're doing there. Yeah, keep reading, keep close, because they're in there. Or the Maidenheads? Yes.
And that is a, like, there's a great book that I've read multiple times by Bill Bryson, who is one of my favorite authors, A Walk in the Woods, classic book. He writes a great book about Shakespeare and about Shakespeare's life, where he dissects the what's going on in that time period and how Shakespeare is viewed. And you're exactly right. It's like, we now all think it is very highbrow and very, yeah, it's like, oh, no, it was straight up like this was the crassest of like yeah. the masses came to watch this. It was basically a sitcom or like a soap opera for that time.
It's the equivalent of the That's What She Said of the time. That's exactly. Like, you made a dirty joke.
Yeah, and you mentioned how, you know, to further connect it using sitcoms and whatever. And as soon as you said that, and you said Seinfeld, instantly, my favorite episode of Seinfeld of all time, the Muffin Tops episode, where it's the episode where Elaine, she opens the bakery where she sells just the muffin top. Meanwhile, Kramer is doing the Peterman bus tours. And then Jerry, he's dating the woman and he shaves his chest. So yes. You have all of these different storylines, just incredible. They're interweaved, but they're alone on their own. I did not until right now ever stop to think about connecting that to Shakespeare and acts in plays or anything like that. So, I mean, you were doing this 20 years ago. That's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I was 12 years old, child genius. And no, I was, it was the 90s. And I was that young male English teacher mm-hmm. that was unmarried, by the way. And I'm teaching poetry and wearing vests and Mandarin collars. So,
ooh.
Yeah. I think kids had lots of stories to tell about me.
I was, my specialty as an English major was poetry, so we'll just leave it at that.
All right.
So hey, I got to go back
podcast on that.
Yeah, totally. So I want to know more about Jam. Like, tell us about that, because I am super intrigued by that idea.
So it's mobile device management. It started 19 years ago. We're coming up on our 20th year. I became aware of it because I was an Apple geek from way back, and I would go to Macworlds and. As part of Q, I produced the Educator Strand. So Jamf was sort of a fixture. It is the world leader. I mean, it's not overstating it. And I could say this, I would have said this a year ago before I started working for them. They are the world leader in Apple device management, hands down. They started in education. Jamf began at University of Eau Claire, and they needed something to manage all these Macintosh computers across the campus. And so these two founders basically wrote a program that would become Casper. You might know the name Casper. Casper was the product until it became renamed Jamf Pro. And Jamf stands for, I think if you look it up, it stands for just another management format. But we internally, we have a different acronym that starts with just Apple. And I'll let the audience fill in the last two letters. Okay, so that's the internal. It's not official. No one, I will deny it if anyone asks. But that's what we focus on. So we don't do Chromebooks. We don't do Windows devices. We only do Apple. So that's including Macintosh devices, of course. And then when the iPhones and the iPads rolled out, then those things. And then iPads and everything exploded. And all of a sudden, people were looking around. How do I manage rolling out, you know, 10,000 iPads in my campus? Oh, well, we should use that company that that manages our Macintoshes and our iPhones and our iPods. And so Jamf continued to provide. We have same day release. Whenever Apple comes out with a new OS, we roll out our solution to make sure that it supports it. We've been doing that, I think, going back 10 years now. So that's what the MDM world is. Recently, they started acquiring some companies to expand to include security solutions because we're all super concerned about devices, making sure that they're secure as well. They acquired another company called Zuludesk, which was a very specifically targeted MDM solution for classrooms and for schools. It didn't have the huge functionality and the big distribution capabilities of Jamf Pro or Casper, but it had a real targeted solution that had apps for parents, teachers, and students to lock down the devices so that you could focus the kids' attention on very specific things. That's now called Jamf School. So we have essentially three MDMs that we provide. Jamf Now is sort of a real lightweight a tool that can be used by small companies. And then Jamf School for any school institution of a certain size. And then if you get big enough and you have enough Macs, then you probably want to go to Jamf Pro because it's got all the bells and whistles. So that's the tool. And with the acquisition of Zuludesk and the rolling out of Jamf School, they needed folks like me that understood how to talk teacher and curriculum and, you know, CNI people and TOSAs, as well as the CTOs that they've known how to talk to for years, and the IT directors and the Apple admins and the sysadmins. And so I have that bilingual language that I can speak, and I understand sort of how to do that. And I you know, thanks to the work at Q and the county and teaching, I've got a network of educators that I can call on, bring in to speak about thought leadership things. So it's been a fantastic ride first 2 months. I started on Star Wars Day. Sorry, Kyle. I know it's, you know, not part of your faith.
No, I love Star Wars.
Okay,
now.
You're in now.
It all just right. Took me until I was an adult to appreciate it. So okay. No. So May 4th.
He's a late bloomer. He's a late bloomer.
Yeah. Okay, good. See, he knows May the 4th be with you.
It's a very important day.
It is. Yeah. And so when I started and they saw, you know, Darth Vader holding a Frappuccino behind me and BB-8 and, you know, Grogu. And then when I have my desk in standing mode, you can see Boba Fett and C-3PO up here. They're like, you're starting on Star Wars Day and I see all Star Wars behind you. I got Clone Wars over here. Nice. So yeah, they're like, I think you might be a fan. And yeah.
I'm just saying, I may have lightsabers in my office, and whenever kids come in, they're like, can we play with those? I'm like, if you're good.
Yeah. When it's set up, is an entire wall of Funko Pops that are Star Wars. So
good job. There you go.
My small claim to fame was 1 year someone nominated George Lucas for a Q Award, and I was like, yes, please. Yes, I don't control it.
They show up.
I mean, there's a whole committee that does this work, and God bless them, because I could never decide between the very, you know, worthy nominees. But this committee decided, and in their wisdom, they decided, yeah, let's give George Lucas a technology leadership award. And so we announced the award to George and his people, and you know, we say, you're welcome to come to Palm Springs, and we'd be happy to give it to you. He says, thank you, but no. And then we say, well, we could play a video if you want to record a video accepting the award. And he said, yeah, I'll do that. So George, it's this great moment. And I love you, George, if you're watching, because I know you're a follower of the Beer EDU podcast. But George, you can tell there's a reason the man was behind the camera, right? He's not on camera talent. Yes. So he's clearly got a teleprompter, like way too far away from the camera. So you watch his eyes and he's like, I'm so honored to receive this award from computer using educators. It's my great honor to be recognized as the technology leader of the year for the state of California. Thank you all for, you know, anyway, he's a great guy and he was heartfelt. I could tell, but he's just not, you know, he's not Harrison Ford. He's not hitting the marks he needs to from a standpoint. But all that to say, he sent Jim Daly, who was then the editor of Editopia, to accept the award. And I clarified with Jim on stage. I said, so, Jim, just to be clear, this means that I'm officially a Jedi now, right? And everybody laughed and chuckled. And
I have a certificate framed in my office that says I'm a Jedi. Oh, sent to me by my friend, so I don't care. It says I'm a Jedi.
All right. Well, have you hung out with Yoda at the, at the Skywalker Ranch?
Oh, you got me beat, though.
Sorry. We can go on this for a whole other
episode. This is a whole other podcast. We know some people that might do a whole other podcast about Star Wars.
Yeah, Zach Logan, we're talking to you right now. So with Star Wars Talk. So again, plug in his podcast. Yeah. Check that one
check
out
that
wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
But thank you for asking about Jamf. It is my joy to sort of share just how awesome this company is. Not just in the tools, but everyone I talked to before I got hired that works at Jamf, they're like, Mike, this is an amazing company. The community, the connect, they really care about their employees. And I got to say, 2 months in, it's absolutely true. I mean, I feel welcomed. I feel supported. I feel like it's a family. I feel like we can all let our geek flag fly. You know, it's just a blast working here.
So do you primarily work with educators, or do you also work with on the corporate side with like their training and education too, or is it just educators?
So I'm entirely on the edu side of sales, and technically on the sales side, but that's not like I've got a quota or anything. I'm essentially here in a strategy role to help everyone on the sales, on the EDU side of the sales equation. So occasionally they'll pull me in when it's like the furthest I've gone outside of K-12 or higher ed is when it's a university medical program. And so they have to have people in there that know how to talk about health and proper management of iPad devices for patients, but also the fact that it's an institution with faculty. And so I come in and play in those roles. They aren't going to bring me in for the big, you know, we just had a one of our clients in France that is an advertising agency. I'm not going to be involved in that, but I see the notifications of, hey, we just had this thing happen and this great agency is going to use our product. Right. And so it's nice to be a part of a larger company. That's a first for me. I've only ever worked in education technology. So it's nice to see sort of how education fits in within a broader scope. But yeah, I'm absolutely on the EDU side, and it's where I belong. It's my people. So,
And I ask because I just, as I'm reading more and I'm like looking at more technology and things like that, it is very interesting to me that those of us who work in education, and then you realize there's this whole other world in the corporate world where you actually provide educational services as part of a larger corporate entity where you're like, oh, you're right. There is opportunity for training and those kind of things. And I think clearly what you're describing, I could totally see that applying to other areas besides a K-12.
Yeah. And certainly corporate training is a huge industry in and of itself. It's not an area where they've pulled me in any capacity. I'm still sort of structured within the K-20 realm. It includes, you know, charter schools, private schools, you know, homeschools, all the realm of K-20 really is where they keep me focused. And then they put me in charge of that stuff. They found out that I have a background in events and they said, can you help us with ISTE? And I go, oh yeah, I know ISTE. Like, you see that I'm wearing this, right? Like, I was on the board. I served two terms. I can help you with ISTE. I know that event. And then they said, okay, we'd like to do a series of webinars. Do you have any ideas for speakers? I'm like, yeah, let me text Peter Reynolds, see if he's available. And so Peter gets right back and they go, okay, great. We got Peter Reynolds. And then I text Taylor Molly. Taylor Molly goes, yeah, sure, I'm in. So it's like, we're just going down the list. Let me text Saba Kidwai. Yeah, she's on board. What else do you want? And so it's a blast. I'm just getting to do all my favorite things.
Now, you mentioned before, Jamf, that you were with PowerSchool. So this is another one. If correct me if I'm wrong. This is a student information system organization. Is that correct?
Primarily, yeah. That's what it started out as in 98 when it was founded. And it was another student who realized that his school needed a gradebook program. And so he wrote it. And then it turned into a student information system. And it became the very first student information system that was web-based, which became very interesting to a company called Apple because they were trying to sell computers to school districts. And the school district offices said, yeah, we love Apples, but we need to have something that'll run our student information system. And at the time, all of those systems were running on Windows servers. So Apple got tired of that. And I think they just acquired PowerSchool so they could have a student information system that was top of the line, by the way, and it was web-based. Therefore, it could run on a Mac server. It could be supported by Macintosh hardware. And they held onto it for 5 or 6 years, sold it to Pearson. Pearson carved it out and sold it to a company called Vista. And Vista still owns PowerSchool, although they're going public fairly soon, I think. And they'll have an IPO. I left just before the IPO. I have terrible timing. And I came to Jamf just after the IPO. It's like, pick the worst possible time. Way to go, Mike.
So and, those stock options that you may have had an opportunity at, no dice. So then,
yeah, you know, regardless, it's not about the money. I'm in education. Come on,
right?
So PowerSchool has in the last 6 years, I think, acquired 14, possibly 15 companies. I left in May, so it's possible there's more. But they have added, the functionality. So they have this approach to build a tool that could have so many different add-on components and still only have the one main vendor that you work with, the one support line, the one invoicing. And it's a great strategy. The idea of consolidating all of it so that educators can go, oh yeah, does PowerSchool have something that does that? Yeah, they do. So they have HR, they have an LMS. They actually acquired two LMSs. If you remember Haiku, and then they acquired just recently Schoology. And they also have, I mentioned HR, they have a professional development tool. They have a finance tool for the back office to handle all the invoicing and payroll. And that's a huge behemoth. And then they acquired recently a counseling career, college and career guidance tool that links up with universities. And so it's just been in this massive expansion. And it was an amazing ride to be a part of. I was in the marketing side of things, not sales, but marketing. And what I ended up doing was managing the advocacy programs, which is what you and I would call evangelism, right? So customer advocacy. Internally, they called it advocacy. And that was a blast. I got to work with the happiest, most enthusiastic customers day in and day out. It was awesome. It was hard to leave. And it was an amazing team to work with. It also taught me a little bit more about community. I knew a lot from Q and the work I had done previously, but this taught me a whole different perspective on what that looks like from the vendor's perspective. And I also was the guy in the room that, ironically, the title of advocacy had a dual meaning because they were the customers out there advocating for PowerSchool, but I was the employee at PowerSchool advocating for our customers. I was like, hold on a second. Everybody over here was saying they wanted this feature before that feature, and everyone over here really wishes it worked this way. And so I would often be the one talking to product and sales to try and make sure they understood, here's what they're looking for from us as their provider. And so it worked both ways. It was a great, great ride. And I learned a tremendous amount from a great team.
So in all these roles that you've had, and I think Kyle and I have talked with multiple people about this, we've talked about ourselves, like looking back at last year and the interesting world that we all are now living in. I mean, where do you see us going now? I mean, like what do you see is going to be the next thing that will help us kind of bridge this new normal that we're going to be in?
Right. Well, I feel like, and I don't know if you guys felt this way too, but I felt like last year in March of 2020, we got called up to the big leagues. By we, I mean the EdTech community. Like anyone that had any knowledge of how to use these technology things with the kids suddenly got asked to do their job plus another job and maybe another job. Some of our friends, I'm sure, were doing basically three jobs. Okay, you're going to be the tech director and you've also been sort of the integration coordinator for the teachers. Now we need you to fire up and run an online school on top of all that, those other things. Oh, and set up the training for all the 80% of the teachers that have never taught online. Do that too, please. And so all of a sudden, all of my network went dark because we were all just head down trying to get stuff done. So for me, where I see this going is it unlocked an opportunity for us as education technologists to go, okay, everyone, we've been talking about this for decades. And some of you were paying attention and great, good on you. You guys actually did better during this whole pandemic because your district was prepared. And those folks that sort of scrambled and got things together, let's work with you. Let's not, you know, hold it against you. Let's work with you, move forward. And let's find a way to make this go back to better, essentially, is the phrase that I keep using, instead of go back to normal. Let's go back to better. Because, you know, there were some students, I don't know if you noticed them, before the pandemic, they weren't thriving so well. And then during the pandemic, they actually shined. They actually had an opportunity to excel. Some of those introverts that weren't being called on because they never raised their hand suddenly were participating more because they were doing more asynchronous work. They were participating more because they could leave their camera on and they could just send you ideas as a student, idea mind to mind, instead of having to be that voice raising their hand and that wasn't going to happen. Or other students that were not being called on because of bias that we were as teachers unaware of. You know, I always had a bias. I taught to one side of the room and not the other. And I didn't learn it until like halfway through my teaching. And it's a relatively harmless bias compared to others that are out there. And I'm sure I have others. But the biases sometimes got turned off when the cameras were turned off and the mics were turned off. Suddenly, all the kids did get a fair shake in some ways. Now, this isn't true for all. I know that there were terrible, terrible situations that were made worse because they were learning from home. But let's see if we can find those silver linings and find a way to be flexible so that the kids that thrived in that environment, let's give them a place to thrive when we go back to better. And those kids that are really struggling, that really need that face-to-face interaction, the extroverts among them, hello, let's find a way for them to continue to thrive in a face-to-face environment. But maybe, you know, it might be good for them to take that Japanese elective that they can't take otherwise because there is no Japanese teacher for 6 counties, but there's one online. And maybe they should take that class because they discovered that it's possible that they can maybe 1 period out of 6, you know, take an elective like that is remote. And then the other thing that got unleashed is parents became, whether they wanted to or not, much more involved. They had to be, right? And in some cases, this created major issues for them to not be able to go to work, to be out of work. But they were home with their kids and they were able to see what education looked like, for better or worse. And it was us not in our brightest moment. I describe in many cases what was happening last year as triage learning or emergency remote. The other thing it was, once we got back into the hybrid mode that folks call hybrid, over here we call it room and Zoom. I describe that as, yeah, because there's roomers, people in the rooms, and then there's Zoomers, people, yeah. My wife did that, and I described it as the worst of both worlds because it's neither great face-to-face teaching because you're having to be locked into one space where the camera's on you because you can't wander off over here to talk to this group and then wander over. And then it's also not great online teaching because it's asynchronous and B, you can't do both. I mean, teachers are superhuman. I know that, but there's a limit to just how good you can be to both environments. I mean, I've done theater. I've stood in front of an audience and I've been a face-to-face teacher and I know what that looks like. And I've done, you know, live virtual keynotes, and I know what that looks like. But never in my life have I had to do a live keynote while somehow engaging the live people in the room. Yeah. And that's just entertaining. Like, I'm whole other level.
I'm laughing only because I don't have many good ideas, but as an administrator, we tried that at the beginning, and my teachers came to me, and one of my teachers said, I can't do this. And we had like a teacher in a classroom and we had overflow because we had max capacity in rooms because of social distancing. And I had the kids in another room and she's like, this ain't working. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. This isn't working. So we made some adjustments. You're right. Hats off to all those teachers who had to do both at the same time. Like that's insane.
Yeah.
That was just nuts.
So all that to say, I think parents have been empowered in some ways. And they're going to be a bit more critical about their choices. They're going to say, you know what? I saw what was happening and I don't think that's good teaching, or I don't think that's worth our time. Let's see if there's other options. So I think it's a real interesting inflection point for public education, because public education had the monopoly for 100 or so years. And with charter schools and school choice and other options that were out there starting about 10, 15 years ago, there was already a disintegration. And public schools were starting to go, how do we sort of communicate that what we're doing here is really good? And so they came up with magnet schools and you know, schools within the district that were charter schools to keep that population with them. But they had to go a step further and have marketing for the first time in education's history. We don't call it marketing, but it's community relations, right? The idea of a communications officer at a school district. I think we're going to see districts lean more and more into that because they will have to sell their services not directly, not in a direct sales model, but in a way that they've not had to think about before. So they have to figure out, how do we tell the story of our schools, our students, our administration as the best on the planet? And here's what they do really, really well. And this is why you should trust us with your students. And so that's a real interesting inflection point. And it really puts the onus on public education to demonstrate their value and how well they can do this.
Well, and Kyle and I've talked about this with other people, is that it's about branding. And we've talked about this, and it's always been like a bad word in education. Yeah. It's on now, because you're exactly right. It's like, me as a parent, what makes me want to put my kid at your school as opposed to doing this? So how can we, in public education, and full disclaimer, like, as an administrator in a public education, I want my kids in my school, not in the charter school down the road. I want them at my school. So how do I brand my school? So I think you're right. I think we as educators need to start tooting our own horn and sharing what's good about what we're doing.
Yeah. I was criticized for it when I was in the classroom. I would call up the local newspaper. I'd call up the little TV station, and I would tell them what was going on at our school and how amazing I thought our kids and our teachers were. And I was accused of being, you know, a media hound that was always trying to get attention on himself. And I was just trying to change the conversation. There's so many stories out there that are negative about education, about, you know, these scores are going down and this happened at this school and that teacher did this silly thing and that, you know, was not wise. And those are the stories that are getting the coverage. And I said, I feel the onus is on us to tell the stories that we want to see on the news. We need to write press releases. We need to invite the media in. So we did things like Science Fiction Night, actually, and I invited Andre Bormanis, who was the science advisor for Star Trek. I know, sacrilege. We were talking about Star Wars earlier. But Andre came in, and he's amazing. And he talked about how he uses real science to advise a Hollywood TV show. And sometimes they listen to him, and sometimes they don't. But we invited the parents in to see that this is the kind of conversation we have. We did tech nights. We did live broadcasts with call-in shows, and we had students manning the phones, because I was solidly in the belief that if we didn't tell a story, then we would let the media tell the story for us. And the story they chose to tell was, time and again, this negative, negative story.
Well, another great point you brought up in that as well was, you were talking about how a student that could now take Japanese online one period of the day, because we know it can be done. And we've had this conversation with others before as well. Not only that, but then these smaller districts and smaller schools that, I mean, especially Nevada. Nevada is so outside of Reno and Las Vegas, so spread out. And now how a kid in Tonopah, Nevada, town of 2,000, that doesn't have access to an AP class, for example, there could be an online teacher in another district that could be taking on kids from those districts that want to take those classes as a result. And then you also mentioned about how parents are going to be more critical now of what we do because they saw what was going on. To flip that on its head a little bit, I also think, though, that I feel that the public, now that they've seen, maybe a little bit more understanding of what we do, though, too, where there were, you know, the people that were very quick to criticize, the first thing they would say is like, you can't do that. That's not going to work. You know, teachers are overpaid babysitters. Insert other insult here. But now seeing that, they're like, wait a minute, these people really are working very hard. So I think you're going to see a little bit of a balance with that.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't mean to cast it in just one light. Certainly.
Oh, no, not at all. I didn't take it that way at all.
Yeah. Certainly there was a tremendous amount of empathy, a tremendous amount of respect and appreciation for, holy cow, I couldn't do that. 6 hours a day talking in a box with, you know, black screens staring back at me. A lot of parents, I think, had that reaction as well. But some of them had that reaction and went the wrong direction with it. Like, okay, why are we doing this? And not necessarily, you know, validating the teachers that they were stuck in this situation and they were not choosing this situation. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it did gain some empathy and some respect for the tremendous effort that educators put in, and they kept just going more and more. My wife had three different instructional models teaching last year. It was fully online, then sort of a low face-to-face Zoom room and Zoom. And then it flipped, and basically just all but five or six students were in the room. And then she still had five Zoomers. So she had three instructional models in one school year.
Well, and that speaks to the whole idea of like, well, education is slow to change. Well, that just ended. Because you just described exactly it. I mean, like, It was like in 1 year, 180 days of instruction, boom, boom, boom. You had to flip that model super fast. So, yeah, it'll be hopefully next year.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it looks somewhat our new normal, because I'm not going to say it's normal, because I tell people all the time, it's like whatever you were doing in 2019, it ain't ever going to happen again.
No, and I think the optimistic hope I have, and I was asked this question in December, what do you hope comes of the pandemic? And my answer is that we are a bit more empathetic towards each other as human beings. I think the you know, there's certainly the basest side of humanity that we've seen in the last year, lashing out against others. But there's also been a tremendous outpouring of empathy and support and recognition and appreciation for first responders and appreciation for, you know, the medical professionals that saved us literally, and the teachers that stepped in, and the firemen that stepped in during firefighters, I should say, that stepped in during these tremendous wildfires across the year. I mean, there's been a nice expansive empathy. There was a video that kicked out of Austin I saw it was fairly early. It was like, end of March was when it rolled out, and the city of Austin shut down like most cities. And this one tour company shot a video of these empty streets. And maybe you saw the video, but these empty streets. And at the end, it said, this may look like the end of the world, but in fact, it is the single greatest global effort to connect with each other and save lives by not going out, by not doing things. And I'm not saying it as well as the video said it, but it was essentially this single greatest expression of love that we've ever experienced as humanity. And I thought that was a tremendous way of looking at it, that by voluntarily staying home and not going out, we were doing an act of love for our fellow human. And I thought that's, if we can hold on to that, right. If we can hold on to a little bit of that for the years to come, when there is no pandemic, God willing, and remember the human on the other side. That's why I shifted what I was speaking on. I was doing a lot of talking about ed tech like usual. And then 2 years ago, I started talking about social emotional learning because I saw that as a crucial topic. And then when the pandemic hit, it just took off. And all of a sudden, everybody that I submitted to speak about social emotional learning said, yes. And can you do that session twice? And do you have any more sessions like that? And so I found that suddenly I was less of an ed tech, called upon for ed tech conversations, and more about what I was seeing in this SEL space and the work that was being done there.
Well, and that's a beautiful little segue, because I was going to ask you also about your branding, like Ben was talking about. You have Maverick Learning on top of everything else that you're doing as well. So I'm assuming that's where these speaking engagements are coming from a little bit.
Yeah, that's the shingle I put out right after I left Q. I launched Maverick Learning. I based it on my Twitter handle. And I was kind of, you know, we all regret. And I heard an earlier podcast where you regretted your first Twitter handle and you changed it to Anderson EdTech. I have some small sense of regret that it has tech in it, right? Because we all know it's not about the equipment. It's not about the gear. And so when I was picking a name, I chose Maverick because I like the name, and you know, there's a new Top Gun movie coming out, so apparently I timed it well. And I thought Maverick, and then some other word. I need some word that sort of fits with that. And my initials are ML, Mike Lawrence, and I'm, you know, obviously an egoist first and foremost, so I needed to name my company after myself. So ML, Maverick Learning. So it was that or Maverick Leadership, and I thought that was too exclusive. So Maverick Learning. So mavlearn.com was available. I grabbed that, launched the consulting firm. And then while I was at PowerSchool, they were super flexible and allowed me to just take off for a day here and there and keynote somewhere or speak. And so I would run that under MadLearn and do that. And when I was at PowerSchool, I just donated my time. I think there was only one or two talks where I was compensated with a stipend because I was fully employed. I didn't need it. So that shingle is still out there. I don't use it much. Occasionally I have people ask me to speak here and there, and I sometimes submit to speak at conferences. But the good news with Jamf is that they're excited to have someone that can go and speak to audiences that resonates with those audiences of educators. And hopefully it's still the case. Today it went well. I had a talk I gave at the Computer Science Teacher Association. We had 150 people in this room just exploding the chat. So I feel like it's a good fit, and Jamf seems to really welcome and embrace that as part of my job. So there'll be probably less and less MavLearn you know, flying high. But you know, it's nice to have. I've thought about flipping it into a nonprofit and just shifting any sort of gigs I get through MavLearn that are somehow not fitting under Jamf into a nonprofit realm, and then just donate things towards things like I believe in, like the California Student Media Festival, where I still volunteer, and any sort of arts education, because I'm a lifelong performer. My son's a music major. My daughter can't stop singing and dancing. So I feel like it's a fit for me to support arts education. So I might do something like that with it, but who knows? I don't know. It's just fun to have sort of a flexible shingle that's hanging out there as a freelancing firm in case something doesn't quite fit your day job, and they give you the flexibility to use it outside as long as it's, you know, your own thing and your own time. So that was that with Mav Learning and Maverick Learning. And yeah, I have tried to go back and change my Twitter handle, but I can't seem to find if, and if only I had gotten in 2007, yeah, in July of 07, I'm sure Mike Lawrence was available, but no. We were all about the handles.
Yeah, but it's like once you have it and then you have like followers and everything, and you're like, I'm done. It's just, that's who I am. Yeah. You got to embrace it, man.
Just break off the key. Yeah.
So speaking of that handle, you said at Tech Maverick is your Twitter handle. And then you mentioned, what was the website again for Maverick Learning?
MavLearn.com.
MavLearn.com. Okay.
Yeah. Great. I have a professional website at MikeLawrence.me. Perfect. That's just my resume, basically.
All right. Well, we'll definitely include all those in the show notes so others can connect with you further and pick your brain about some things here, because I know Ben and I did a great job of that this time we had together.
Yeah, no, I'm like super fascinated with like that whole, I do think that's a whole untapped, that like the support, the tech piece, and it's not just about the tech. And I love to hear that like you're talking about SEO, because I do think, I agree with you 100%. I think that we have moved now because of post-pandemic, but whatever you want to call it, but we have to start talking about mental health. We have to start talking about social emotional learning of students, of staff, of like families. I think that is, it is out in front right now. And I think that is, that's going to be key. That's going to be key this year.
There's an article that I'd been feeling this way for some time. And then this article came out and I feel like it captured my feelings really perfectly. It's out of EdSurge and it's called Education Has a Three-Headed Crisis. Mental health is only part of it. And it identifies three areas, and it's like called a hydra. So our mental health crisis, you just referenced, and it talks about anxiety, and it talks about, and it has like legit data studies that it goes into. Then it talks about a creativity crisis as the third crisis. And I skipped over the second one. The second crisis in the article is empathy and human connection. Those are the three crises that they identify in this fantastic EdSurge article. I'll see if I can drop it in our chat here and you can share it out with your viewers. Yeah, but that really sort of resonates with me. And I've been talking about question formulation technique and design thinking, which starts with empathy.
Yes.
And the series of set webinars that I told you about with Jamf that we're doing, Jamf sessions, it was like I had someone to talk about empathy. I had someone to talk about creativity. I had someone to talk about anxiety. It was like lined up. And then I read this article and was like, are you listening to me? Did you write this after? But no, it's a fantastic article, great author. And she cites her sources and really points us, I think, in the direction where education needs to look in terms of tackling that hydra, as she describes it. In education, here's three ways you can address those three crises. So I just keep sharing this article with anybody that'll listen to me.
Perfect. We'll make sure those are in this in the show notes for sure.
Yeah, and yesterday, in fact, I did a session with a co-presenter, Delaine Johnson, out of Clovis. She's a Q member and presenter, and we've kept in contact and we've been co-presenting a bit. Yesterday, we did a session all about Ted Lasso and what he has to teach us in education. And he's a coach, right? He's a fictional character, of course, but the writers, Jason Sudeikis, Brendan Hunt, and others, Joe Kelly, and they lean on John Wooden and what his lessons are as coaching, and they applied that in this TV show. And so we just took, springboarded from the show to several different lessons that we drew for learning from Ted Lasso. And we had like 100 plus folks sign up. It was one of those things where we just captured the moment and it started a conversation around empathy and learning. And we had folks from both sides. We had folks that had seen the show and loved it and never thought about applying it to education. And then we had folks that had never seen the show, but now they want to go back and see the show. So you're welcome, Apple TV. Yeah, just in time for season two to come out next week. It resonated. And so talking about these things that are a little beyond technology is really fulfilling for me, the teacher part of me, the performer part of me, and the father, the parent part of me. So it's an interesting evolution. When I was at Q, we started talking about how we stopped looking at it as education technology, and we just called it education. And I feel like now with the pandemic, it's even more so true, because there is no going back. We're not going to go back to a pre-digital education experience. Yes, there's always room for paper and pencil, and sometimes that is the best tool. But moving forward, this will always be a part of the equation. Which device will you use in this circumstance? Is it the right thing to use online, or should we do that in person? Should we do that synchronously or asynchronously? These are now all part of the lexicon that before 2 years ago really was only in the online and blended world, right? Which was a segment of our ed tech population. Now it's education. We don't need to give it a qualifier.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for taking some time out, joining us here. So many great things that you shared with us tonight. We can't thank you enough.
Yeah, it's been amazing. Thank you so much, Mike.
It's been a great conversation. I can't wait for part two and three.
There we go.
We go into our Star Wars episode and we go into our Shakespeare episode.
There we go. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, let's get a jump start on that, listeners. Keep the conversation going. Yes. Share some of your thoughts on today's topics by emailing us at info@beeredupodcast.com. Tweet us at beeredupod, #beeredupod. Hit us up on Facebook, beeredupodcast. That's all one word. Follow us on Instagram at beeredupod. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can watch the live streams of these at bit.ly/beeredu YouTube. Be sure to follow Mike again at Tech Maverick on Twitter. You can send us a voice message using the Anchor app. Leave us a review wherever you're listening so more can find the show. And Ben, if others would like to be a guest on the show, what must one do?
Yes, go check out beeredupodcast.com. You just need to click on that subscription and info link and then complete the guest form. You'll get in the queue. We'd love to hear what you're passionate about. You know, what is your thing? You know, like I said, awesome having Mike on to tell us all about, you know, talk to us about what he's into. And then also we cannot forget School Rubric, because they're featuring the Beer EDU podcast. And, you know, check out schoolrubric.com. Their mission is to help schools, educators, parents, and students tell their stories so that stakeholders can make the best choices about enrollment and staffing. So check out them at schoolrubric.com. And then also, we are super proud to be part of the Codebreaker Podcast Network. So please check them out at codebreakeredu.com. You can check out not just the Beer EDU podcast, but they have the Staff Room podcast, STEM Every Day, Teachers on Fire, My EdTech Life, so many amazing podcasts. And we're very proud to be part of that group. And this is the part of the show where, Kyle, you're going to talk to us about something about beer. And Mike, love to have you stick around so we can learn about, Kyle, something. I don't know, Kyle, what do you got for us this week?
Oh, see, normally you cheat and look ahead of time and say, hey, I can't believe we didn't do that one. You didn't do that this time.
I scrolled down on the show notes as I was looking through it, and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah, I knew we hadn't talked about this one, so I wasn't even going to bring it up.
Oh, okay. I finally got something
you right
that
there.
You got me finally, right there.
We're back on track with our discussion about hops. I will say that.
Yes, indeed. So this time it's about the Chinook hops. So now, when I hear the word Chinook, I think salmon. So growing up in Great Lakes, that was one of the species of salmon that was in the Great Lakes. A lot of fun to catch, by the way, on the runs in the springtime. But no, the Chinook hops, this was something that was first bred in 1985. So not as new as some of the ones we've talked about, but still a relatively new hop. It's another cross between two previous hop varieties that were specially bred for disease prevention and flavoring and whatnot. But unlike the other hop varieties we've talked about before, these are used primarily for bittering and aroma, not for flavor. So whereas the other ones were put into the beers for the citrus flavors, the pine flavors, the florals, whatever it may be. These are for bittering and for aroma. Now, how does that happen? Bittering is when you put the hops in at the beginning of the boil. So it's going to extract as many of those oils out of there as it possibly can. The aromas, you get those when you add the hops towards the end of the boil, because the oils that are extracted from it, they're not going to be broken down from a long boil. So they're still going to be fresh and you're going to get that aroma on it. Whereas the flavoring, you get it anywhere in between, depending on what style of beer you're doing, what flavors you're going for, you would add the hops in at that time. So these Chinook hops are either going to go at the beginning of the boil or the end of the boil as a result of that. So what are you going to get from these? You're going to get a slight spice. You're going to get a very piney aroma from these. So these are the ones, if you've got a beer that right. smells like a pine forest, there's a good chance there's Chinook hops in it. So
right.
Very common in your American pale ales and your IPAs. You can find them in winter ales, barley wines, and porters and stouts as well, though. So you've got some very, very famous examples here yes. that use Chinook hops.
I did see your list, so spot on, brother.
Yeah, so Stone's Arrogant Bastard. Probably, I think that was the first yes. Stone beer I ever had. Incredible, incredible yes. beer. That one's just an American ale. It's like it's kind of its own thing. It's not an IPA. It's I think it's more of just like an amber ale.
Well, and I see in your notes, that is literally the only hop in that beer.
That is the only hop that's in that. They use just Chinook. So the flavors you're getting is all from the bittering right. on that one. They're putting wow. it in at the beginning, and that's what you're getting with that one. And now I got to go to the store and get an Arrogant Bash because I haven't had one in a long time.
Classic.
Yeah.
I meet you guys in San Diego. We can pick yep. up some.
Stone.
Yeah.
That's the yeah. go-to in San Diego.
There no, that's a great beer. Again, I haven't had one of those in a long time. And then its cousin, the Double Bastard, the one yes. that's basically like 12%. That one's really good too.
Also good.
So Sierra Nevada, one of our favorites.
Yeah.
The Celebration Ale that comes out every year around Christmas time. One of my favorites. I look forward to that every year. That one has Chinook hops added to it. A great Imperial Stout. I believe this company, they brew in both Utah and Colorado. Epic Brewing has a Imperial Stout called Big Bad Baptist that uses Chinook hops. So if you've never had that one, it's great. And they barrel age that one too, Ben. So
nice. You're
welcome.
For that one.
You're welcome. And then another one of your favorites, New Belgium's Ranger yep. IPA is a Chinook hops as well.
That yeah, and I do love, and I didn't realize that was in Sierra Nevada. So a little bit about, you know, I don't know what it says about me. My dad every year gets me two gifts. He gets me a case of Celebration and a really good bottle of scotch. That's it. Like, and I get him a really good bottle of port. So I don't know what that says about my family, but that's what we do.
Well, aren't you Scots Irish? Partly.
Yeah. So, yeah. There you so go. It's either Irish whiskey or scotch. It's either one. I'll drink either.
Yeah, you don't. Well,
I'm glad. I just thought Chinook was a helicopter. I didn't even know.
There we go. Running.
See, so I learned two things right there.
We are here to teach. That is what we do. Man, that's Kyle. That is and I will say we've never talked about this one, but I knew we had not. So that is I was not aware of. I think the Arrogant Bastard, that's interesting that is legit their only one in there.
Well, and that completely threw off everything I had learned in the research about Chinook hops. And then all of a sudden it says, this is the only hop. And wait a minute, this is not used for flavoring. So, but then I'm like, well, I'm not going to question it because that's a great beer. No,
that's a great beer. That is a great beer. So, hey, I guess that wraps it up for episode 109. Mike, thank you so much for being on the show, man.
You bet. This is a blast. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. And listeners, thank you as always for your support. And until next time, may the malts and the hops be with you.
Right on.